Welcome to the second edition of the PFA podcast. My name's Beau Bush, and for this month's podcast, I sat down with former Matilda Tal Karp in her offices here in Melbourne. Tal enjoyed a career at the very highest levels of the game, playing in the World Cup and being an Olympian. But at the peak of her powers, she decided to walk away from the game to pursue a legal career. Tal's legal career has seen her hold positions at some of the most well-respected firms in Australia. And also, recently, she has begun working for the Victorian government. Hugely respected on and off the pitch, Tal has continued to make an enormous contribution to the game, even though she hung up her boots after the second season of the W League. In our wide-ranging chat, Tal discusses with me what it was like to be a young girl growing up in WA, desperate to pursue a career in football, but regularly being shut out from the game, to eventually the early days of the National Women's Soccer League, her time playing at the World Cup, becoming an Olympian, and just how far the game has to go to achieve its enormous potential. I hope you enjoy the chat just as much as I did. So welcome, Tal. When we were kicking around ideas of who'd be great for this, you were the first person that came into our mind, so no pressure at all there, but we're really glad that you've taken time to come in out of your very busy schedule to speak to us, so thank you.
Not at all. Glad to be here at 8 a.m. in the morning, might I say.
Indeed. Hopefully we'll get some coffee to keep us going throughout. So we're at a point now with women's football where we're seeing record numbers of young players. The Matildas have absolutely inspired a nation. But can you tell us a little bit about how you became involved in football back in WA?
It was a long time ago. My mother actually tells this story, and it's a bit of an embarrassing one. And I was 7 years old, and I was watching the TV at home, and the Men's World Cup was on. And apparently the game really resonated with me, because at some stage, in an absolute fit of excitement with these chubby cheeks and pigtails, I jumped to my feet and told everyone in my lounge room that I would play World Cup soccer. The embarrassing bit was that my mother caught that on videotape and continues to embarrass me with it to this very day. But I was really excited and captured by the game, watching the Socceroos, didn't see the Matildas on TV at that time, and I thought I needed to obviously see where this would take me. So I went down to the local field, the local club, to see if I could play. It was my brother's team, and I asked if I could play. I was so excited about the game, and then I was told, well, actually, no, there was no place for me. It wasn't a game for girls. I should be doing something a little bit more gender appropriate. Which was really interesting at that time for me, and quite devastating, because as a seven-year-old, I didn't realise there were less opportunities that might be available to me because I was a girl. I was very stubborn. I wanted to play, so I continued to ask that coach week in and week out, and finally I got my chance when the team didn't have enough players and they realised they would have to forfeit or let me play. So let me play they did, and apparently, again, according to my mother, I rely on all of these historical facts through my mother. I played, I did well, I scored a goal and was able to stay on with that team, and then spent the next decade really playing in Premier Boys teams in Perth.
Absolutely. I guess by the age of 16, you're in junior national team, so it was pretty clear that not only did you have a big passion for football, you were also pretty darn good at it. But what was it like being a young and aspiring footballer, in Australia at that particular time?
Look, it was a really exciting time, but it was also an uncertain time. So it was really exciting to make that first national team, the under-19s national team, as a 16-year-old. Previously, I'd made national squads, and as far as we went was the Institute of Sport in Canberra, and we'd have a camp there, and there were no travel commitments. And finally, I'd made a team which allowed me to travel. But it was uncertain in the sense that there wasn't a clear, defined career path. It was also really uncertain because I was in year 12 at that time. It was during my HSC year, and this trip to the Netherlands was actually just over a month before my HSC exam. So it was the start of a realisation that playing soccer for my country, playing football for my country, and loving football could also potentially jeopardise my academic career. And it was a choice that I would have to way up, and a lot of people told me that I was really silly going away on that trip, and that I was putting my whole academic future in the balance. So it was the beginning of a debate for me about what the appropriate use of my time would be moving forward.
Absolutely. By the time of 1996, some sort of semblance, I guess, of a career path did emerge, and we had the start of the Women's National Soccer League, and you were part of Canberra Eclipse in that inaugural season. Can you tell me a bit about what it was like to be a part of that first national women's competition, and whether there was any sort of semblance of professionalism, I guess, at the time?
It was such an exciting time. Previously, we would go away for week-long trips with your state team, and you'd have to fundraise and find money from Freddo Frogs for, you know, months and months in advance. And then suddenly I, as a young Perth girl, was being flown over to play in Canberra and elsewhere, and not playing for a week at a time, but rather I think it was two games at a time in these different conference matches. And it was just so exciting to see that there was the start of something, the start of a sustained investment, well, some investment, let's say, a start of making the game feel a bit more serious, that we were doing something where you didn't just have to wait 11 months till the next one-week competition, but you'd play for a longer period of time, and you could see the girls progress in a dramatic way as a result.
In 2002, you got your call up for the Matildas. Now, that came about after you had a bit of a brief stint, I guess, with the very brilliantly named Adelaide Sensation in the Women's National Soccer League, and you went back to Canberra and rejoined the Eclipse. But what was that moment like, finding out that you'd finally been called up to the Matildas after all that time of staying back as a seven-year-old watching the World Cup, saying, that's what I want to do?
It was such an incredible time. It had come after a lot of sacrifice, if I can say that. After I'd finished my year 12 year, I moved to Canberra to live there because there wasn't a pathway in Perth. So I left everybody that I knew and all of my friends back home, and I moved to Canberra, and I became quite obsessive, if I can say, about my training. It meant so much to me to train, to try and make it into the Matildas, and I think I put far too much pressure on myself in the early stages. So although I'd made train-on squads, I didn't quite make the cut, and that was really quite painful. Then around 2001, 2002, I started to decide that I needed to relax into the game and just enjoy it and let my playing, show for itself. And I started to play the best football that I had played until that point in time. And it translated into making that first national team. And it was just the culmination of a dream that I had for forever. And it made all of that sacrifice so very worthwhile.
Absolutely. You touched on a lot throughout there, the sacrifice that you made, and particularly, I guess, the toll that it put on you from being a perfectionist, I guess, and wanting to make the Matildas and live that dream. But were there other elements of sacrifice at the time? I imagine perhaps financially, or even, you know, you were pursuing a law degree, correct me if I'm wrong, at the time. So was it quite difficult to balance all those sort of competing priorities and still trying to be the best possible footballer you could be?
Look, it really was. For me, it was very much a time of balance. I couldn't throw all of my eggs in the football basket. There wasn't a defined career path at that time. So for me, having moved from Perth away from my family home and to Canberra to try and make it to the national team, I was balancing a double degree in law and arts. I was training, and we had significant training commitments at that time. And I was also working because I had to make ends meet. So it was just this period of getting as much as possible done in a very short period of time. But it was such a great learning period for me and such a wonderful time. So although I did have to invest a huge amount into making it to that next level, I'm really glad that I did.
In 2003, you lived the dream of any footballer anywhere in the world, and you went to the World Cup. What are your recollections of stood in the tunnel prior to coming out to that first match against Russia?
The World Cup for me was always that thing. Like I said in my story at the beginning, it was that competition that I dreamt and aspired towards getting to. And then finally, when I'd made it, and I was in the United States, we were supposed to be in China, but it was SARS year, so suddenly we ended up in the United States. And walking out onto that pitch for that first game and seeing my late grandparents who had flown all the way from Perth to be there holding up signs with my name on it, I can't actually get that tingle away when I remember that time. It was that all of that work had paid off, and that perseverance can get you where you want to go. It was such a moment for me with my team, and then singing the national anthem and playing. It was one of the best times for me.
For sure, I can definitely appreciate that. I guess 2003, as we've just discussed, you go to the World Cup, you live every footballer's dream, as I've already said. 2004, you become an Olympian. But then that same year, or very close after doing that, becoming an Olympian, every athlete's ambition in the world, you've achieved it. At the peak of your powers, you decide to walk away from the game. Can you sort of give us a bit of an insight into your thinking at the time and why you felt that was the right decision?
I think throughout those years of playing for the Matildas, I always had this lingering feeling that at some point I needed to get serious about my life, because there wasn't a career pathway at that time. And people kept telling me that, you know, when are you going to wake up and realise that you need to create a future for yourself? And that future at that stage wasn't in football. So when I came back from the Olympics, I came back with a determination that I needed to throw myself into the law and create myself a future that had opportunities for advancement and financial stability. I was never motivated by money, but at the same point, I needed to see a future ahead of me. I didn't intend to retire. I intended to take a break from international football, but immersing myself into an honours degree in law, an associateship with a judge and so forth, it became very clear that I didn't have room in my life for two fast-paced activities of that nature. And so it became a retirement from international football.
When you look back, do you wonder at all what may have happened if you'd tried to balance both, or if you'd maybe put your legal career potentially on the back burner till later? Do you ever look back and wonder what may have happened, or financially, was that even an option really at the time?
I absolutely look back and wonder. And I also wonder, you know, what my life would be like if I was growing up now, when things are so much different for the young girls growing up, and there are opportunities to be contracted and to play for money. At the same stage, I'm comfortable with the decision that I made, because at that time that was the lot that was available, and it was really important to me to see my career going somewhere. So it was very much a balancing act, and I suppose I'm just really glad to see that moving into the future, girls do have an opportunity to make football a career to some degree, and hopefully that continues to progress in the right direction and they don't have to make the decision that I did.
Thankfully, it wasn't the end of you, I guess, in terms of sort of seeing you on the national scene. And when the W League got started in 2008, you were part of the inaugural Melbourne Victory team as captain, no less. Why was the decision made for you to come back and play after what I imagine had been, it was a good amount of time you'd been out of the game for it, and you were probably fairly busy as a very promising young lawyer at the time?
Law did very much become my new football, but I couldn't get the feeling of wanting to play and needing to play football, I think, out of my system. And the idea that the W League was starting, this was a whole new competition associated with the A League. It was exciting. It was a new era, it felt, for women's football. I just felt that I really needed to get back in there. And as an older player compared to the young ones coming through, I felt that I had something to give to the game at that period of time, and I tried to figure out how I might be able to balance what was a very demanding work schedule with football at the time, and it was really tricky. I was working for a judge, living in Melbourne, but travelling to Canberra for sittings, and then on the weekends I would travel to play games in different places, so I wasn't able to train all the time with the girls, and it was really difficult juggling those two commitments, but I'm really glad that I did it.
Why was that? You touched on in your answer there the alignment between an A-League side and a W-League side, and that wasn't something that we'd ever seen previously, but what was the impact of that, and why did you see at that time that was important?
Being in Melbourne then for a couple of years, but having my background in Perth, I often went to A-League games and got caught up with the excitement of, you know, being in these big grandstands and watching these guys play and seeing their fan base and seeing the professionalism with which that they were associated. And then suddenly having a girls team as part of the A-League setup, well, in its own W-League, but with that cross-pollination, made it feel like we'd made it, that we were, you know, going to be put on a similar platform, or at least it was going to be emerging that we would actually have professional conditions, have access to facilities that befitted our capabilities. It felt like the game was moving in the right direction and we weren't just an add-on or something, you know, to the periphery, but that we were part of the A-League club.
Absolutely, fantastic. In the after your two seasons with Melbourne Victory, you made the decision to, I guess, finish up at the sort of top level, at the elite level. But your involvement with the game didn't end. Can you tell me a little bit about, I know you've held various roles on boards and you've continued to have a very sort of quite active role, I guess, at some points more active than others, in involvement in the game, particularly in an administration point of view. And you've also, correct me if I'm wrong, got your coaching qualifications in your, what I imagine is pretty sparse spare time.
I think when I retired from the game, I still had this real sense that I had a lot to contribute to it, even though I mightn't have the time to be a player. And that was one of the reasons that I retired from the W League. I just physically didn't have enough time to get to training at 5:30 or 6 o'clock on the other side of the city when I needed to be in the centre of Melbourne finishing my work or be interstate. I still felt that there was so much that I could give to the game given my experience as a player. So I started off thinking, well, I'd like to be a coach. I went and did my C licence and then my B licence and played and coached in a young development team, which was really worthwhile and exciting to see the calibre of the young players coming up. But the next foray for me really was in an administrative sense, seeing if I could help contribute to systemic change on the board. So I ran for the board of FFE and had a period of time there. I'm no longer on that board. But I think I've always just really had a sense that I have something to contribute back to the game. And despite not currently coaching or being on a board, I hope I find another opportunity to do that in the near future.
In your answer then, you mentioned that systemic change was something that you were really keen to see. In your mind at that particular time, what did that sort of look like? And I guess the second part of that question, how sort of successful do you think you were at that time, or how much change did you see during your time, particularly at FFE or more broadly in Australian football since you have finished up in the W League?
As a player, you often see certain aspects of the game that you really feel need changing. And one of those aspects for me was the way that the state of women's football was treated. And so the systemic change piece there, or one of the many systemic change pieces for me, was trying to figure out how we could put women's football on a different platform and give it, give it what it needed, whether it was making sure that women had access to the public spaces and the facilities that often young boys' teams get access to, and making sure that there was a pathway for these girls to go through. But, women aside, it was also a systemic change piece for me of making sure the game is accessible to as many people as possible. We pride ourselves on the fact that football is this accessible game, yet there are so many people that aren't able to play because of the costs associated and so forth. So that was another passion for me, making sure that players, whether females, whether because of your background or whether because of being in a regional area, you're able to access this beautiful game.
Absolutely. As far as where the game is at currently, where do you see it more broadly, I guess, as Australian football, but also specifically the women's game and where it's come from? There's been a lot of change in the past sort of 2 years, I guess. We've seen our Matildas go off to a World Cup and create history, go further than any Australian team's gone before. As I touched on earlier in the interview, we see record numbers of participation. But from your point of view, where do you see the game more broadly and also the women's game?
Firstly, I guess starting with the women's game, I really feel it's at the best it's ever been in the course of my lifetime. And that seems to also be tracking with a lot of other women's sports. It's like a tipping point at the moment. There's some great momentum behind the game. There are record numbers watching, whether it was at the World Cup, the last Women's World Cup, and there were 27 million Americans watching the game. I think there was 60 plus million watching worldwide. There is an appetite for watching elite women's football, and it's just growing from strength to strength. But there really is a long way to go, both with women's football and with the game more broadly.
As you've said there, there's a huge amount, a great appetite. I always like to think almost an unmet demand for women's sport around the world, but also perhaps locally in terms of just the game in general. What do you think is the key to sort of unlocking that potential and moving that sort of great, I guess, unmet demand to realising this game's significant potential?
I guess it can't just be about aspirations in unlocking these things. We need to have measurable actions. We need to have targets, and we need to measure ourselves against the progress that we make, whether it's about the professionalisation of the game, and we do need to have more sustained investment into the game so that women can know that going through that there is a professional career pathway. But we also need to be considering other aspects of professionalism, like access to facilities. We need to be considering representation of women in leadership positions, whether it's in board positions or in coaching levels. We really need to be looking at how we can use all the levers available to us to be making the changes that we need.
We've seen change, I guess, particularly in the W League, the past 12 months with the W League players coming on board for the first time and being members of the PFA. What sort of role do you see, having been a player yourself and now also worked in the administration side of the game, that the players have to play in I guess, creating positive change for the sport?
I think first things first, players need to play. They need to do what they do so well on the sporting field, and by doing that, they can really set an example. You know, they can challenge the stereotypes that have been so often associated with what an appropriate women's role is, and they can create the buzz and the excitement that the Matildas have been creating when they're overseas and or even at home and playing against the world's best and competing and doing such a good job. So that's the first step. But I think the second step is the awareness piece. Players need to be aware of the conditions and what being an athlete involves, and they need to ask questions. And that's something that, looking back, I probably didn't do enough as a player. I was just so excited about being involved and playing the game that I love that even as a young player studying discrimination law at the time, I didn't really turn my mind enough to what the inequities that I was facing really meant. So I think being aware and being willing to engage in conversations is really the next step for players.
Absolutely. And just finally, I want to finish on something that you mentioned in your application to become part of the Football Federation Victoria board. In it, you said that football's been a huge part of my life and my identity. I guess, how has the game actually shaped who you are as a person today? And more broadly, how do you see its role in terms of shaping, perhaps, it's maybe a very big and bold ambition, but for the game to shape the nation itself?
Yeah, football really has been very much tied up with who I consider myself to be, and it's taught me so much growing up, whether it was teamwork, whether it was discipline. It really gave me a sense of belonging. It taught me how to deal with difficult situations. It really made me feel more confident and gave me some of the best friendships that I have ever had. It also gave me this universal language. When I was overseas, I could communicate. Regardless of being able to speak to somebody, you could just play the game that you loved and others would come and play too. In terms of nation building, I think I mentioned before, we often talk about football being this accessible, game. It's often regarded as this multicultural, diverse thing that everyone can come together and play regardless of age, background, capability, gender. And I think in terms of the nation building piece, we need to really be careful about not just relying on that brand of football, and we need to take steps to ensure that it is that accessible game, that everybody has access to those opportunities regardless of age and gender. And when we do that, I think we'll really build as a nation.
Fantastic. Thank you, Telkar.
No worries.
So that brings to an end our chat with the truly remarkable Tal Karp. It's great to have people such as Tal as part of the football family, and we hope she continues to play an influential role. I hope you enjoyed the chat just as much as we did.